Okay. Time to start. Most of you have, I guess most of you have looked into this, the task you had today, or you are to deliver it by the end of the day, I think. This short paper where you're going to identify independent and dependent variables and look into operationalization of terms or variables and say something about reliability and validity. Most of you, I guess at least half of you have delivered it already, and I guess most of you have looked into it. So let's just start by trying to answer the short questions there. For the first paper, let's take the Kansas paper first. Kansas is flatter than a pancake. Anyone, what's the independent variable there, or variables involved? Anyone? Come on. It's not very difficult, is it? The independent, huh? Kansas and the pancake is obviously the, or I say obviously because in retrospect most people see it. Probably some 20-30% of you have not identified that as the independent variable. Why is it the, why would you say this is the independent variable? Well, let's go one step into the paper. What's the hypothesis we're stating there? What's the research hypothesis? Yeah, the research hypothesis is Kansas is flatter than a pancake. So you say something about Kansas, and you say something about the pancake, and you say flatter. So two of these are what's changing the measurement of the mid variable there in this sentence. And the dependent variable then is flatter, flatness. So what you measure as flatness is the dependent, as we have defined it, right? And there comes this thing about specified terms. Because flatness could be many things, but flatness as it is here is this calculation of flatness that they have, the formula for flatness that they decided to use. Right, so the independent variable is the state of this basic variable, Kansas versus the pancake, or two states of Kansas for that sake, two states of that variable, Kansas yes, no. And dependent is then the flatness. And as I said, this specified terms is then the ratio they have discovered, they decided to use. Are there other terms that should have been mentioned? I think there is. And that has to do with reliability and validity, especially validity. The state of Kansas is probably okay, and they have defined it in a pretty decent way. They said that Kansas here is this cross-sectional slice they've taken. I don't know if it was east-west or north-south. East-west. So they've taken a slice there and did some calculations on the flatness based on that. But the other part isn't very well defined, and that is the pancake. Well, they choose to buy a pancake at a specific shop, which is one method of doing this, but this has to do, of course, with the validity of the study, because can you generalize from that pancake to all pancakes? Probably not. So these are then discussions about the validity of the study. What about reliability? You remember the definition of reliability? How stable the measurement is. Will they get the same result if they do it again? But what if they do it on the same pancake? No, they wouldn't if they used another pancake, probably. And they wouldn't have gotten to the same measurement if they used the pancake that I've made or something like that. But if they used the same formula on the same pancake and on the state of Texas, they'd probably get the same result. Not over time. Right. The pancake would probably change over time. Right. So there are questions with the reliability, of course, as well. But the measurements they've decided to use is probably pretty accurate. The measurements they get from the electron microscope or whatever they use there, it's probably pretty good. But of course, what about the validity? I'll get more back to the validity and reliability later, but is it valid? Is Kansas flatter than a pancake? Yes, somebody says. Yeah, I think it's questionable, at least, because they're really comparing two things that isn't comparable, and they're using two different scales for measurement here, which is quite different. They're comparing miles and miles with micrometers, for instance. So there's something there that doesn't fit with what we call the phase validity. It just doesn't seem right. And there are mountains in the horizon, I think, somewhere there. Okay, laptop use then. What's the independent there? Users or non-users? Computer users versus... Yeah, okay, you can say it's computer usage. But again, it has two states. Yes, no. User and non-user, yeah. So that's the state of the two states of the variable, but you're absolutely right. The variable is computer usage. And the state of that variable is yes, no. And that's a pretty common thing to see when we do different types of research. We're defining one topic and we switch it on and off. And that's the manipulation we do in the experiment or in the study we do. And of course, dependence. It's what we measure, right? That's the dependent. So it's not visual noise as such, because that's just a conclusion. What we measure is their attitudes towards a number of questions, and we make some indexes based on that. So it's the responses to the questions, you could say that's the independent variable here. We didn't do any observations, so it was only the responses to the questions. And, of course, then we treat these questions in different ways and collect different variables out of these questions. So you have things there that academic use versus non-academic use. You have the reasons for not using and stuff like that. And we see whether that's dependent on whether people are using or not using a PC in the classroom. Is it reliable? Well, in many cases that can be calculated, of course. We can see whether the different classes respond in the same way on the questions. So we can compare this. It seems like people understood the questionnaire and responded in a quite reasonable way. In the same way, both the years, for instance, they were quite similar. And that tells us that it seems like a pretty reliable measurement. But of course, here, as in the first one, you can also here question the validity. Maybe we asked the wrong questions. Maybe we didn't take into account some background factors. I don't know what it was, but there are a number of possible issues that has to do with validity here. Validity is then in this case, what we can call the generalizability of the answers or on our conclusions and results. Okay? I will, the folder that you're going to deliver this hand in is open till tonight. If you mixed up the variables in the first paper, which some of you have done, well, you get a new chance. I'll reopen the folder and keep it open till the weekend. Okay? No, I'll just wrap up on some things we didn't finish last time or last week. And that is the topic on, or all these things that has to do with causality. To say that something results in something else and is responsible for that change. Cause-effect relationship. What we talked about last time was mainly what we could call a direction problem. That you can't necessarily say that one thing leads to another thing. But maybe an even bigger problem is what we tend to call third variables or confounding variables. There are different words used on this. And this has to do with the uncertainty on whether maybe other variables are involved when we draw conclusions. Relationships are often, in the real world, a lot more complicated than a simple cause-effect thing. There tend to be other things involved as well. It comes in between. I'll just give an example. I don't know if it's easy to understand, but I've done some research on what we call sensation seeking, and that's something we call an individual personality trait that has to do with how risk-seeking are we? How much novelty are we after in our lives? Do we seek stability and safe environments, or do we confront things all the time? And there are different tools for measuring that. And in a large census or population study where some 20,000 people were involved, it's a national health survey that's taken place, I think, every fourth year or something, we asked the question, or we included a questionnaire that had to do with sensation seeking. And of course, in that questionnaire, we could also pick out a number of other, this study, which involved a huge number of questions, in addition to the instrument for measuring sensation seeking. Well, in that study, we also measured a lot of other things, and we correlated some of these things just to do it. We didn't publish anything on this because it's somewhat controversial as well. And difficult to interpret. Because what we see is that sensation seeking on such a large study with 20,000 participants results in, well, there are always a lot of correlations. It's always very small effects, but it's correlations and they come out as significant. We'll get back to the significance term later. But it seems to be a stable statistical connection between a number of behaviors and responses to other questions and this term sensation seeking in this study. For instance, measurements on attitudes towards sexuality and sexual behaviors. Which, of course, may lead you to the conclusion that sensation-seeking is a good way to measure risk-taking sexual behaviors or something like that. And that could be, that's a typical conclusion that you see in a lot of journalism based on these types of studies. But there may be difficulties in drawing these conclusions as straight as we are doing here, or in the beginning here. Because there are other relationships as well between sensation seeking and other variables. For instance, age. The younger you are, the higher you score on sensation seeking. And that's a very strong relationship. And by the way, gender is also a strong one. Boys are more sensation-seeking than girls, for instance. And to take this one step further, there is also a very strong relationship between age and the behavior, the sexual behaviors we're measuring here, or sexual activity or whatever. So what's the main factor then? Is it sensation-seeking, or is it the other variables that also has to do with sensation-seeking, like age, like gender? And this complicates things. Of course, this makes it difficult to do these types of conclusions, because should we take the strongest factor? Well, we have statistical techniques to control for these things. And when we do it, when we balance in age, for instance, in this formula, and when we take in gender and stuff like that, the effect or the way the measurement that we had here on sensation seeking disappeared, more or less. So what was a significant strong effect isolated vanished when we used statistical techniques to isolate, or where we included the other confounding factors here, or some other factors. See this? And this has to do with the problem of a third variable, or a confounding variable. Sorry, this one is in Norwegian, but it's included here. Should you understand it anyway? Because there are, of course, the X is the, let's say, the independent variable, this y is the dependent variable. And in a straightforward way, you could, the confounding variables could be irrelevant. It could be a very separate factor. Like, let's say that age was a separate factor here. And even if we kept age into the equation, it would still come out as a relationship between our independent and dependent variable. Well, that's the ideal situation, but what's tend to be the case is that a set or many sets, many confounding or third variables are involved when we are going to draw conclusions. It can be part of the answer. Both X and Z can explain the variation of the dependent variable. It can be a prerequisite, because it's only when set is there that there is a relationship. That's a more complicated thing to isolate in statistics. Set can be an intermediate factor, So we have to go via Z to get to Y. And it may be something that explains both of them. And in our case, H, for instance, seems to be one of these, a factor like this, in the example that I used. H was manipulating both these measurements, and it's not necessarily a relationship at all up here. So that's one of the problems with third variables. So what we aim to do, of course, is to try to control for this. I mentioned different statistical techniques that we can use in to do this. There are a lot of techniques to allow for this in variance analysis, ANOVA, which we'll get a little back to later. We can add these factors and see how they contribute and how the effects would be without the these set factors. We can try to control for factors that we know are existent by counterbalancing them in experiments, control groups, for instance. If two groups have the same age distribution and they score different on something, well, then age is not the factor, then it's something else. So what we tend to do is that we use different methods to collect data. This has to do with planning, and it's often very difficult to do this afterwards. So potential third variables is something that we always should aim at either controlling or at least measure when we do studies. And there are a number of these factors we know always are there, or at least for a number of social phenomena that has to do with humans, we know that age tend to be a factor. We tend to know that a lot of demographic factors like level of education, like income, background factors, stuff like that, whether you live in a city or rural. Stuff like that are factors that we know are existent, at least in questionnaires. Then we should make sure that we measure some of these factors, and so that we actually can control for them when we do analysis of data. Okay, that's the problem with third variables. It's a really important thing and an issue where we fail a lot in research. We erroneously draw conclusions about relationships while there actually are something else that's the reason for what we saw. Reliability and I took that quite rapidly. Of course, reliability, whether the results that we get are consistent, is pretty easy to understand when we're talking about the speedometer. It's more difficult when we are measuring a concept with some more vague measurement, like observations of behavior, or like using a questionnaire or stuff like that, which has a lot more error to it. But we can do different estimations of reliability there as well. One type of reliability that we often refer to when it comes to measurement instruments is what we call the test-retest reliability. If you did the same thing over again, of course this is the speedometer thing, would we get the same result? And on a speedometer, it's pretty straightforward. It's if the wire hasn't broken or some dirt on some electrodes. I don't know how this works today. But it should be pretty okay. It can be difficult with questionnaires or tests or stuff like this, because the first measurement will probably influence the next measurement. But there are ways around that as well. You can do what we call split half measurements, that one of the, or half of the population gets the first half of the questions first, and the second half of the population gets the second half of the questions first, and then we compare this in what we call the split half thing to control for test effects, for instance. So there are different ways of controlling this test-retest reliability. There are methods and there are statistical techniques for it. Another problem is what we tend to call the inter-rater reliability. Again, a technical measurement where you use a machine to measure something is pretty straightforward, but if people are doing it, if, for instance, people are asking questions or observing behaviors, scoring behaviors, or trying to analyze something out there, well, will different people do it the same way? This is also something that one should calculate in the when you do some kind of research. It's easy to do because you only have to register who did the scoring as part of the data gathering, or as part of the data sheet that you make. And then you can see whether there are some systematic differences between different people in the way they have observed things. For instance, if you're going to observe some phenomena like the choices people do in shops or whatever, that you're going to observe that and score it on a sheet, and one person has scored a lot more of one type of behavior than another person, well, then you have a reliability issue with your measurement. So these are things that you should take into account. A very special form of, you say, it's not what we could call an inter-rater reliability, but we may use different methods to collect data. For instance, some people may answer something electronically on their PCs, while others get questionnaires and hand them in by hand or something like that, and by post, or are interviewed face-to-face. These are very different ways of gathering data. And it's not, at least we should make sure that the results that we get from the different methods that we use for data collections are actually comparable and not only slap things together. Right, so this should be looked into, and it's a special form of inter-rater, could say, reliability, this method thing. In questionnaires, and at least the off-campus students will use a questionnaire as their project here, they will, in that questionnaire, when we have an the off-campus students are going to use a questionnaire that we are using to measure this, or I probably mentioned it, a personality variable that we call cognitive style, whether you want to handle information visually or verbally or spatially, actually, you want to relate things to each other. In this questionnaire, you have 45 questions, where 15 questions asks about visual preferences, 15 asks about verbal preferences, and 15 asks about spatial preferences. So they score into three scores. And what we want to make sure in this questionnaire is that all the questions that has to do with visuality or visual preferences, they are consistent with each other, so that they all measure the same basic effect behind it, or personality trait in this case. And to do this, we calculate something called Cronbach's alpha, which is the mean, actually the mean split half coefficients of all. It's very difficult, but you can see it when we do this analysis, and I'll probably do this sometime in the end here as well. Because you get a good indication about the internal consistency of each factor. This can help you to reduce the number of questions, for instance, but it also gives you a good indication whether you are measuring something that's pretty stable across different questions and across people. Validity is neither a straightforward thing. Validity can be many things. You can find words like these, and you can find other distinctions here. We tend to use different terminology on this. Construct validity has to do with the terms that we actually use, the theory that we use when we say something about what we are measuring. Are the operationalizations that we have of a concept the right operationalizations? When we say we are measuring, when I say I'm measuring sensation seeking, is it actually sensation seeking I'm measuring, or am I measuring something completely different? This has to do with what we call construct validity. And we can skip the next one and go directly to the, or maybe I can say something about content validity as well. Do we measure the right things? For instance, if you're going to say something about school performance or academic achievements on a in the basic education to measure how good students are, is it correct to draw conclusions on academic performance only by measuring their skills in mathematics, for instance? Probably not, that's obvious. But a lot of the erroneous conclusions, and something that leads to low validity in some studies, is that we tend to measure just a slice of the phenomena that we're going to generalize to. We say something only about a few special factors and not about the outcome in the end or what we're going to generalize to. That has to do with content validity. Phase validity, on the other hand, that's very relevant for the Kansas study. Phase validity is whether the conclusions that we make about relationships actually seems right. And in the Kansas case, well, it doesn't seem right to compare a pancake and the state of Texas, right? It's very different. So even though you can say that you have a reliable measurement here that says something about the relationship, the phase validity isn't good because they use different methods and well, it's just a saying, it's not correct, right? And then you have some special types of validity as well, something we tend to call predictive validity, which is goes, say, more or less against all the other types of validity, or may do. Because there are instances where things can be quite valid, even though they are using obviously wrong or probably wrong constructs or terminologies, even though they are measuring something that's very irrelevant or seems very irrelevant to what we're going to predict, and which doesn't seem correct at all. And a very good example of that is a test that's now nowadays commonly used in pilot selections when they're selecting airline or fighter pilots, military pilots. This scene where they are selecting pilots is a very good test bed for standardizing tests, etc. Because you have a group that you know a lot about, and you can just bombard them with tests. And something that the Swedish Air Force did some 20 years ago was that they included a test which was probably psychologically interesting, and maybe only that as the beginning, that had to do with what they called perceptual defense, which was something you could say was a defense mechanism in a Freudian sense, when you are dealing with suppressing memories, more or less, how well you observe the world. This test is what we call a tactistoscopic test, where you flash pictures to the person that you want to test for longer and longer periods, or you start off with just flashing a picture for, let's say, 1/30th of a second or something like that, and then you mask it out so you can't get an after image, and then you steadily increase the exposure for this picture. And the picture, when you look at it in the beginning, seems like, well, there is a girl playing with something on a desk. That's the most obvious thing that you see in the center of the picture. When you get more time to look at the picture, you tend to see something else. And that is a male that stands above this little girl. That looks very scary and frightening. He's about to attack her or something like that. So the dependent variable in this, when they are developing this test, then is to see whether the exposure needed to see this male person, the longer that is, well, the more perceptual defense you have. So it was a way to measure this perceptual defense as a defense mechanism in Freudian sense. But what was interesting was there were no theories on this, and it's very difficult. It may be very difficult to explain it, but it showed to be the one and only, or the one and strongest indicator of accidents or near accidents for pilots. When you looked at things 5-10 years later, the higher perceptual defense, the more likely these pilots were to get into trouble. So the construct hadn't at all to do with pilots. They measured something that hadn't anything to do with flying, not the least. There wasn't any reaction times or anything like that involved either. The phase validity at the time wasn't very good to see. Why should this measure something? Why should this have something to do with strong, tough guys? But it came out as a very good predictor, a very valid predictor of performance, and it's still in use. It's called the Krags test of perceptual defense. It's a Swedish test. So it shows you that validity can be a number of things. It's not a straightforward thing. It may be a very complex phenomena. And in some cases, it's the least expected things that shows out to be valid. But the point is that these things need to be discussed and analyzed and thought about before conclusions are made. Test validity is one thing. In experiments, you also tend to use another type of validity that has to do with the validity of your conclusions. And you then tend to split it into what we can call internal and external validity. Internal validity has to do with whether the conclusions you draw and the generalizations you draw is correct within your experimental setting. If you did the same experiment again and under the same circumstances again, well, you would probably get the same type of results and could do the same conclusions. Then you have a reliable, now you have an internally seen valid experiment. You've drawn the correct conclusions about relationship between variables. And you would probably get it again. But maybe it's just an experimental artifact. Maybe it's something that just occurs in your laboratory. If that's the case, well, you still can have high internal validity, but the external validity, the validity of your conclusions, may be completely wrong. So, of course, the first one, internal validity, is a necessary prerequisite to have external validity. You need to have it there. But even a very valid, or even very valid conclusions in an experiment isn't necessarily generalizable, because you have ignored some important factors in your equation. So just to wrap this up or finish this. This is often a thing that summarizes this a lot. To have a valid measurement of something, to be able to draw some valid conclusions, you need to have reliability as the base. But even though you have a good reliability in your study, it's not necessarily a valid study that you perform. So validity seems to be a bit more difficult to achieve than reliability. But reliability is a good prerequisite to be able to draw valid conclusions. Okay, it's not time to start with anything new, so let's take a 15-minute break now.